So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, Tuesday is the anniversary of the first Tarzan movie to hit the silver screen.
Then on Wednesday, we tell the story of how Gottlieb Daimler inadvertently invented the motorbike.
On Thursday, we explain how MSG got demonized in the 1960s.
And on Friday, we revisit a legendary battle on a frozen Russian lake.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Ollie Mann. On today's show, Brexit brings uncertainty and big gains for Fleet Street in the latest circulation figures. And there's a new paper that's, brace yourself, already making a profit. Are there good times ahead, or will reduced ad spends hit the press hard? Elsewhere, our pundits discuss the treatment of Channel 4 news reporter Fatima Manji, what little we know about the new culture secretary, and the latest attempt to bring US satire to Britain. Plus, a quiz that will leave your head spinning. That's all to come on today's Media Podcast. And it's summer. It is, honest. So we're on the roof terrace at the Hospital Club this Friday. Joining me this week, a man who needs an introduction. It's the managing director of TV indie Lemonade Money. It's Faraz Osman. Faraz, hello.
Hi, Ollie. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How many Pokemon have you caught this week?
I'm on level 8, and I've got 27, I think. I'd need to double check.
What's the most exotically named one? And are there some that do sound like they should be sex toys?
I'm firing it up. The problem is that whenever I fire it up, it crashes because it's a shitly made part app. But it's not controversial. Everybody knows it's a terribly designed app, but it's incredibly fun.
So speaks a man who clearly doesn't care about working for Google or Nintendo.
It's not with Google anymore, is it? And it's not really a Nintendo product. It's built in Unity. It's not fun. All the nerds will tell you, don't build apps in Unity. They're all going to die.
Okay, come back. This isn't a tech podcast. What else is taking up your time, Faraz?
We are in production of a new series of the award-winning Four to the Floor. So that's keeping the office very, very busy. We're actually doing a load of pitching at the moment, which is actually quite surprising considering it's summer. But it's good. There's a lot of work out there, and we're hoping to grab some of it with both hands.
In augmented reality or in actual life?
No, we've talked about VR, actually. There's an ongoing debate about VR and if it's going to kind of create a new wave or if it's going to be like 3D and be a bubble that pops very quickly. So we're looking into it. I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to see lots of people sitting in their living rooms wearing headsets and immersing themselves that far. But for video games, I think it's amazing.
And alongside Faraz this week, a man who eats 12 Pokemon for breakfast. It is BuzzFeed special correspondent James Ball. James, welcome to the Media Podcast.
Thank you very much.
A debut, I believe.
Yep, first appearance.
I just said trepidatiously in case you were on a week when I wasn't presenting and I couldn't be asked to download. Welcome along. I imagine you've been fairly busy recently. You write about news and politics.
We kind of looked up, I think, about yesterday and realised it was sort of 4 weeks since Brexit, and we'd kind of been working very much all the hours. But we're kind of now just slightly getting our reward. It was sort of last day of term yesterday, so we had hero puppies visiting the office, trainee guide dogs, literally just as a, you've all had a horrible month, here are some puppies.
I mean, it's tricky.
New media's great.
It's tricky, though, isn't it? If you want to be a political journalist, if you want to work in that kind of world and you want to do it online, fast-paced, breaking news, then the stories we've been seeing over the last month, you know, Brexit, Trump, Nice, Turkey, new Prime Minister, Corbyn, everything, that's kind of the stuff people live for, but then I guess it just also gets a bit much.
Well, you get no time to enjoy it. Like the political sort of stuff, we've had basically about 18 months of political news in 3 weeks. And so you're just getting warmed up for a Tory leadership contest. You're digging around, you're planning how you'll do the features, the people around them. And then Andrea Leadsom drops out, and so you've got a new government in 2 days later, they've appointed the cabinet. And it's kind of like, hey, this is great, but Newsmageddon.
I'm guessing there weren't plenty of features on Owen Smith ready to go.
I mean, you know, Owen Smith, the internet's darling. Amazingly, there are now meme artists starting to try and make Owen Smith memes because there are so many Corbyn memes. And they're working with thin material, but they're getting there.
Right. Let's stick with Brexit, sort of, for our first story. No, only sort of, because one of the implications of Brexit has actually been a benefit to the press, something that we predicted in the last episode. Of course, people are buying more papers, at least in the short term. All the national titles put on readers in June. Putting the hard copies aside, even online, James, we've seen boosts as well for the Mail, for the Guardian, even the Telegraph website, more people going to online news as well. I mean, that is good news, isn't it, for the news industry?
I suspect it's a big sigh of relief, actually, as you've kind of... No one's really wanted to be talking about this, but website traffic hasn't really been going up anymore, and it's actually been sliding. If you look, most months, the biggest few papers, you know, the Mail, the Guardian, even the Telegraph a bit, I think, have had month-on-month drops. Like, you're not seeing this big sort of peak traffic era anymore. And so the fact that really big global news can move the dial still counts. But I suspect, you know, everyone's got to enjoy this while it lasts, but it's a month-long bounce. It's not really changed any of the underlying sort of online world or print world. And so, you know, at a risk of being the miserablest in the room, which is definitely my comfort zone, it kind of doesn't change that the floor has fallen out on print advertising and that circulation has got to trend down. Like, it's a good month, but enjoy it while it lasts, but it's one good month.
And Brexit's going to have an impact on ad sales as well, isn't it? If British companies have less money, it's presumably in the short term only going to be European and American companies that are looking to advertise here.
Maybe. I mean, I think that that's all going to come out in a wash. I think genuinely the reality is that no one really knows, which is why, you know, the markets never like uncertainty, and I'm you know, getting all very boring about that whole thing, but it's the truth. Like, no one really knows. You know, you could argue that as the pound falls, you know, may have more brands coming in, and actually it may feel like they've got a bit more, you know, more international brands have got a bit more of an opportunity to invest in this space. Don't know. It's just so tricky to say. But what I think is really interesting is about how this has been pretty much the first big vote. I mean, obviously there's a Scottish referendum, but it's been the first big vote that Facebook and social media has gone on from being, you know, that whole thing that people talk about with the echo chamber has really been amplified here. I think a lot of people were very surprised with the result certainly with the Remain party, because they all thought that all their friends were saying the same thing, and it was going to happen, and this is a fight that's been fought already. And then when the result came through, it demonstrated that there's literally a real divide in online with the way comment systems and social media exists now, where you've got one camp that's saying one thing and another camp that's saying another thing, and actually the two don't meet.
But it's kind of funny because it just replicates print, really.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, you read the Daily Express, you're never going to read anything good about Brexit, and you know, you read the Mirror and the Guardian, you're not going to read much of the opposite. So it's kind of, it's weird how much the online echo chamber is the same as the other one.
Well, except that's not really true in the comments section, is it? If you go to a Guardian article about why we should remain in Europe, if you look at the comments to that, you know, that's not going to be a lot of Guardianistas saying, yeah, right on, Owen Jones.
So yeah, but no one comments. I mean, it's such
that's
a tiny...
That's not true.
There's a tiny fraction of people.
Actually, I think it's a comment echo chamber. I think there are people that comment on 15 different websites. I think they go to the Guardian, then they go to the Daily Mail, then they go to lots of different places, and they are, you know, they're comment trolls, effectively. I think there are very few people of the mainstream people that are reading BuzzFeed, are reading the Daily Mail, are reading you know, these articles that are going on to then comment about the article. They're spending their time reading it.
I mean, to jump back onto the advertising thing, though, I mean, if you've seen the Enders report, that's terrifying. I mean, they reckon print advertising was going to go down about 12 to 15% this year, the same next. Mm. That was before. Now they reckon 2 years of 20% falling. I mean, that is nasty.
At which point you have to look at the alternative solutions for these traditional organisations to make money. The Guardian has been taking the opportunity to solicit paying members. According to an all-staff email sent by the editor, Kath Viner, that's been going quite well. They've been getting more sign-ups than any other single day on the Friday after the Brexit vote. Do you think that will ever mitigate the drop in ad spend?
I mean, you've got to try a lot of different streams, you know. I think any time anyone's tried to go, this will be the answer, it hasn't been it. You know, video ads at one point, we've got to save everything, and then everyone realised video takes quite a while to produce and is expensive. It's not the one thing. It's got to be online display. That kind of hasn't quite worked. So it's going to be a little bit of a lot of stuff. And, you know, membership gives some revenue, and I think it's giving them a way to do a very, very soft, slight paywall with members-only content, and I suspect we're going to see a fair bit more of that from them, and try and kind of give it a bit of an editorial offer as well as just sort of the donations model.
Yeah, I think it's a strong idea, actually. I think they've taken hints from what Wikipedia do, and you know, there's an appeal of, like, you know, if you value this content, then you've got to help us pay for it, which I think Wikipedia pop up every so often. You kind of go, oh, you know, you use this every day, have you ever thought about helping us actually make it? So I think that they've taken lessons from that. But what I think will be really telling, and I hope that The Guardian are setting themselves up for this, but the App Store, for the Apple App Store, is going to change soon, which will allow for subscriptions, and I think that they're teeing themselves up to be in a good position for that, where you would get the content for free, and then if you want enhanced content, you can pay a subscription model. Yeah. And if Apple are saying that that's the future of the App Store, and The Guardian are in a place where they are moving towards subscriptions rather than paywalls, we could see that being a very successful model.
Or it could be that the future of the press is in pop-up newspapers. There is evidence to back this up this week. The launch, I'm laughing as I say it because it seems ridiculous, but it's working apparently. The launch of The New European. Faraz, what is The New European?
It's a newspaper for Remainers, I guess, is kind of what it's classed at. It's facing the 49% of people who are upset or
48%.
Angry.
Let's not 48%. Have an agenda here, Faraz. Let's play the numbers straight.
Am I rounding up?
It's
48.2%.
48.2%.
Yeah, okay,
yeah.
So let's, all right, 48%.
Bias.
But it's a paper for the 48%. It's an interesting idea, and actually if you look at some of the papers that how they classically were created, they generally were created out of a political movement, and this is our generation's political movement, so it's not surprising that The European exists. It feels like it's a magazine idea rather than a newspaper idea, so if it came out as a monthly, like New Statesman or Economist piece, that I think it might have some longevity to it, but it's an interesting idea. I haven't seen it, if I'm being brutally honest.
I've not seen it on a newsstand either. Have you seen it around, James?
I have. We've actually bought in the office both copies.
BuzzFeed buys newspapers.
We have newspaper
bloody
delivery.
So better not tell Mr. Peretti.
It's to, like, comfort, I think, the old people in the office, which is anyone over about 28. It's just like a little comfort blanket. But, I mean, I'm completely baffled by it. I quite like it. You know, I live in Islington. Of course I like it. But the 48%, we've generally kind of gone, are sort of liberal, they're urban, they're younger. This is not people who are going to get a lifelong newspaper habit. And so I think it's quite cute. I think it's quite a good idea. It's editorially, it looks all right. But, I mean, they say it makes a profit. It's selling, they reckon, 40,000 at £2 a copy. And it's mainly a cover price proposition. So that's, what, 100 grand a week? You're not going to make that much off that, are you?
But what do they hear, Archant, the publishers, are saying this proves is the case for pop-up newspapers, that if you capture the national mood and you get out there quickly with a quick release, and I suppose this would work the same with a TV programme or anything, wouldn't it, that you can capitalise on that.
I love the pop-up idea, I just don't know why we're still printing it onto a dead tree. It's not never going to connect with, certainly I'm probably about as young as any newspaper sort of generation is ever going to be able to grab. You're not going to get today's 21-year-olds into a newspaper habit. You might get them into paying for content. You certainly might get them into quality content. You're not going to get them into papers. So I don't know why we have to still keep printing things.
Do you remember, Faraz, when the routine was the Fun Day Times?
Fun Day Times. It was the best, wasn't it? The best.
Fun Day Times.
I think it was just a pun on its own made it the best, wasn't it? It's a bit like whoever came up with that idea was a genius.
Let's stay with the press for one more story. The investigative news site Exaro closed down on Wednesday. This was days after their owner, News Sparta, had maintained they were open for business in an interview with Press Gazette. They just sacked the site's editor. James, tell us a bit about Exaro for those who haven't actually ever logged on. I mean, they basically do investigations, don't they?
Yeah, and I mean exclusively investigations, and they never really hit any kind of actual revenue model, but they hired some sort of pretty decent people, you know, especially David Henke, sort of formerly of The Guardian. It was run by Mark Watts. I mean, they're known for the child sex abuse stuff, and I think they actually drew a fair bit of criticism for some of how they did that. It was almost a campaign group in places. But when they started it, they had these ideas that it was also going to run almost like a data agency. So they were trying to build this big insolvency database and hired a bunch of sort of 21-year-old investigative journalists. Sorry, like data journalists to build this thing and then just never turned it into a product. And then I think almost they were a victim of their own big story because it took all their attention and it was a complex thing. And so it turned almost into something more like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, kind of something that's using money to produce sort of investigative content but never building a business around it. So it's always sad to see something close, but I mean, they had no model at all.
Do you think that's particular to the internet for us? Because in telly, and I know you do multi-platform stuff, but predominantly you're a TV company, that's not how it works, is it? Like, right from the beginning, if you found an indie, you have to tell investors and you have to tell people, this is our business model, this is how we plan to make money. Somehow, if your business model revolves around the internet, there's still this feeling of, yeah, but one day Bill Gates will buy it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that new media startups have gone around the idea of building an audience first and then kind of figuring out what a revenue model is second, which has worked for a lot of companies in that space. But I think when it comes to content, you know, you have to build the content first and then get an audience afterwards. That's the model that we're in. It's, you know, we need to make quality products that people want to come and watch and listen to or read or whatever it might be. And that's where we get our audience from. So if that's not quality and it's not clear as to what your proposition is there, then you're never going to get your audience, and that's it's. I guess it might be a little bit neater more than anything else. You know, I'd love to run a business where we could just have an idea and just run with it and not worry about the revenue stream. But as was mentioned, making video is expensive, and we need to make sure that we have customers for it.
Sounds like the Queen's about to drop out, bloomers and all, from the helicopter above us. But just whilst we're on this subject, James, were you one of those people who did actually read Exaro? Would you be sad to see it go in terms of actually the journalism you were reading, or did you never really log in?
I have to say, I felt a bit uncomfortable towards a later stage. I think they did some very good and valuable work on the child sex exploitation story, but it felt, perhaps to me, like it editorially started to cross a little towards witch hunting. And I think, you know, some of the people where the police then completely cleared them, there was a real reticence to drop back, and almost it got a little conspiratorial. And I think maybe that hurts sort of the other good work that they've done and were doing, in that, you know, if you cross over, it then hurts your credibility on other stories. So I think they tackled some really tough issues where people sort of don't like to tread, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. But I think they'd ended up in quite an uncomfortable position editorially and with no model. So, no, I think, you know, good on them for trying.
Okay, toothbrush, check. Microphone, check. Novelty T-shirt with the phrase, "It's the death of linear television," written on the back and front, check. Oh, hello, listener. Didn't see you there. You just caught me preparing my overnight bag for the Edinburgh International Television Festival. Just a few weeks to go. The media podcast will be there, of course. Maybe you will be too. Come and say hi. I'll be easy to spot. The T-shirt's bright yellow. It's our biggest show of the year. And as such, we love to push the boat out. Big guests, more interviews, and a couple of days to make the show. What a luxury. If you can't be at Edinburgh this year for whatever reason, we're going to make a show that feels like you're there. The most talked about sessions, the best guests, plus the latest gossip and expert analysis. All we ask in return is that you take out a voluntary subscription, a few quid a month, so we can plan big shows like that and get them to you quickly, and sleep in actual beds. To donate and have your name on the credits of the next edition of the podcast, go to themediapodcast.com/dedicate. That's themediapodcast.com/dedicate. Thanks. Now back to the show. Right, let's cover the other stories doing the rounds this week. Channel 4 and ITN have complained to Ipso about Calvin McKenzie's comments in The Sun. His column, published on Monday, asked why the award-winning reporter Fatima Manji was covering the deadly attack in Nice last week from the Channel 4 studios. In McKenzie's article, he asked, was it appropriate for her to be on camera when there had been yet another shocking slaughter by a Muslim? Manji later retorted in an opinion piece, pointedly for the Liverpool Echo, no fan of The Sun or Calvin McKenzie, of course, quote, "The truth, I confess, I pissed on Calvin McKenzie's apparent ambitions to force anyone who looks a little different off our screens, and I'll keep doing it." Now, Faraz, you're a Muslim, so obviously not allowed to have an opinion on this because it's about Muslims. Seems to be the logic of Calvin McKenzie's thoughts here. What do you make of all of this?
Well, there's a few things I think about this. Firstly, it's obviously utterly ludicrous. The idea that Calvin McKenzie is in any way suggesting that he has any authority in what makes ethical journalism and is obviously laudable with things that he's done in his past. And then in addition to that, there's a kind of almost level of stupidity about the fact that, you know, Muslims are underrepresented in news journalism. There are too few of them, and they should be encouraged and not have kind of white middle class people who have run newspapers such a long time suggesting that they shouldn't have opportunities in reporting big news stories. It's just absolutely awful. But in addition to that, there is also a feeling for me that we're getting to this point with, and you know, it's obvious and easy to draw parallels to what's going on with Donald Trump and what's going on with Louise Mensch and what's going on with I've forgotten her name. What's her name? Daily Mail columnist. Katie Hopkins. Oh, you know what? There's a really nice moment where I forgot Katie Hopkins' name there for a split second, and now I've remembered it as well. But these people are writing things for sensationalism to get... It's clickbait, is all it is. This is clickbait, and it will pass, and it'll be an outrage, and then we'll forget about it, and we'll go on to the next thing. And this just feels like another one of those things where it's like, let's outrage everybody, and let's get loads of people kind of giving me lots of attention, and therefore buying my newspaper, reading my article, and then it kind of goes around in that cycle again. The most terrible thing is, though, is that, you know, what damage is this going to cause? We cannot be discouraging a diversity of voices in news journalism, and that's exactly what's going to happen here.
I suppose you could make the case, though, in much softer tones than Calvin McKenzie did, that it's naive of Channel 4 News to pretend that it isn't a statement, not on this particular issue, by the way, of Islamic terrorism, but it isn't making a statement to put a woman in a headscarf fronting a news programme. No,
that is a statement.
Yeah,
it's a positive statement. Yeah. It's exactly what should happen.
But it is a political statement, and they could acknowledge at least that.
Well, only in the same way that you would argue that Trevor McDonald was a political statement about him being a black anchor on the News at 10 when ITV did that. And if anybody wants to suggest to me that doing that was a bad idea in the 80s, you know, I'm happy to throw a drink over you later on. It's just absolute lunacy, and I think the problem that we have is, you know, going back to what I was saying earlier about how you know, Muslims are underrepresented, and you know, a lot of diversity is underrepresented in different ways. You know, they have an underrepresentation of the disabled community, of an underrepresentation of the Chinese community, and of the black community when it comes to mainstream news journalism. So Channel 4 doing this is a good, positive thing, and it's particularly important when, let's be honest, there are a significant amount of negative news stories about Muslims that happen on the news, and having that delivered by people that are from a more diverse workforce suggests that there are people from the other side as well. The figures are 0.0001% of the Muslim community have any sort of sympathy with this, you know, these terrorist atrocities. So we need to show more positive faces of that faith, and likewise across all communities.
And if you want to jump on Calvin McKenzie's logic as well, you know, someone of the same ethnic group as a violent attacker shouldn't report on it, you're pretty much going to have to fire every white man in news.
And you would have, to take your point for us, you'd have had to have said that Trevor McDonald could never have reported on an African warlord. You know, it's completely ridiculous.
But, you know, most murders, men, like, and most of them white, like, the logic is just bafflingly incoherent as well as racist and unpleasant. I mean, it's just, I think if Calvin McKenzie wants to sort of do idiotic throwbacks to 80s racism, that's up to him. You know, he did most of it in the 80s too. I think the questions are for the Sun's editors, you know, for Tony Gallagher and his team. Why did they publish it? Why are they trying to stand by it? Because there is... I just cannot comprehend
are
how
they,
Ipso will
Are they
ever.
Standing by it? No comment, they've said. That's not standing
is, which,
by it.
From the Sun's perspective, as a business, which is kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier about Brexit, this is the problem that we have at the moment in news journalism, that actually, if you're going to run it as a business... What Calvin McKenzie said and what Calvin McKenzie did means that we're talking about it here, and unfortunately that means that a lot of people are going to go and read that article, and there's going to be lots of advertising based around it. It makes business sense to be outrageous like this, and that's a problem.
Let's talk about Channel 4 News and their response then. James, it seems they actually asked the Liverpool Echo to feature Manji's column. Was that a good idea? Bear in mind, that is politically loaded as well.
Yes. I mean, Channel 4 News have always been a little bit more willing to tweak the tail and sort of, you know, be a little bit bolshy sometimes. And I think that's sort of part of the joy of the broadcast. But I think if they'd have done anything corporate, if they'd have tried something like a Sun no comment or one high-handed statement, it would have been a really bad signal that Fatima was out on her own. And I actually think they've been really commendable in coming out absolutely full-throated, defending the integrity of their reporter and her right to be on air. And I think if they hadn't have done it energetically, it would have been almost a form of complicity. So I think they've absolutely been the right, done the right thing to stand by their staff very visibly. Because I think when you do have such issues getting diversity in newsrooms and getting the news, the people who sort of tell the news to look like the country, to not back someone who's kind of in that position really visibly sends a horrible signal. And so, yeah, maybe it's a bit cheeky, maybe sort of, I could see it annoying a traditionalist or two who feels he should be very buttoned down and adult, but no, screw it.
And Faraz, do you agree with that, just from the point of view of, if you were running Channel 4 News, would you be taking this, not on this issue, but this line of, we're neutral in broadcast, but in non-broadcast media, we have Jon Snow ranting about Gaza, or in this case, video blogs and articles defending strongly Fatima. It does get clickbait as well, but it does slightly undermine their neutrality, perhaps, when they're on air.
Well, I think there's two things to unpack there. I think the first is that, and possibly the most important, is that Channel 4 News have a responsibility to their staff and ensuring that they are, you know, well looked after. This is, you know, you are a face of a brand, and it's important that they take that with a level of respect and ensure that those people are protected when they're attacked, and this is exactly what's happened here. So I think that Channel 4 need to do everything that they can to ensure that both her as an individual and the wider community and their audience are correctly.
But on the question of neutrality, you know, if Kathy Newman came out and made, this seems somewhat unlikely based on what she's done this week, but if she came out and made a very strongly pro-Corbyn video on the internet, is that okay?
Well, I think that we have to allow journalists to have their own voice, and we can't stop that now. With social media existing, the idea that once you sign up to be a journalist for a broadcast news network, it means that you no longer can have an opinion. That's just not viable. And you can either put your fingers in your ears and ignore it, or you can, you know, you can just allow that to happen and allow people to have their own characters.
But the BBC don't, do they, basically? Your BBC News reports, you have to be bland off screen unless you're in Strictly Come Dancing. You can't talk about politics.
But I think that's part of the problem with the BBC and how they can continue to move their news journalism forward. And you know, they are respected for their impartiality. That's why you go to them. But the reality is that Channel 4 as a brand, as a news brand, is respected because it has that level of character that means that you continue to go back to it as a result of it. So I think it shouldn't be the same across the board, and that's why we are blessed in this country to have that plurality of media. But it is, I think in this instance, it is absolutely necessary. And I would hope, and I would say this, I would hope if the same thing happened to a... Like, my cousin's a journalist, and she's done a lot of work for the BBC. If she was attacked like this, I would hope that the BBC would come out and defend her just as strongly as Channel 4 have in this instance, because we should not be leaving these people out into the lurch. They should feel confident about the job that they do and not be demonised and attacked along the way.
Let's move on to talk about the new Culture Secretary, Karen Bradley. Not a name that many of us were whispering about before. James, no. Who is she?
So, I mean... It's a big promotion for her, and it's a good sign that Theresa May is very, very loyal to her Home Office ministers because, I mean, Karen Bradley was a very junior minister. She wasn't even a Minister of State in the Home Office. She came up through the whips and did sort of 2 years in the Home Office. I looked up her record in Hansard when she was appointed. She's never once said the word BBC in Parliament, and she's referred to Channel 4 precisely once when she was answering a question about Jarl's Wood. And so it's not as if there's anything to point to say she has a deep and abiding interest in culture, media or sport or regulating any of them. So it feels a little bit like she's been given the fun cabinet job as a kind of reward for loyalty. You know, very, very few people from the Home Office failed to get in the cabinet. So, yes, it suggests perhaps that Theresa May doesn't have huge plans or ambitions for something she wants to accomplish in DCMS. I may end up regretting this, but it feels as if she just wants a steady as she goes, I have other things to focus on right now agenda.
And actually, Faraz, that might mean the media breathes a sigh of relief after the last year waiting to see what Whittingdale was going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a collective cheer that went up when John Whittingdale left this post. I think there are very few fans of his within, particularly within the broadcast sector. So that I guess is a good thing. I think that, you know, what we need to look at is whether or not this signals the idea that there was almost too much meddling in that space in a time when there are concerns around the economy, there are concerns obviously around Brexit, there are concerns around the NHS, there are concerns around the police force, there are concerns around the prison service. Do we also need to be starting a fight with the media world as well? And actually, if you look at media and sport in particular, that department is a very positive force for Britain right now. And as we come up to the Olympics, I mean, it wasn't that positive during the Euros, but as we come up to the Olympics, I think it will give a bit of a bounce in the sense of kind of British pride, as it were. And I think that's what they're hoping for. So you kind of want a safe pair of hands that's not going to rock the boat around that too much. And if you can put in the argument that she's got some training wheels on and is catching up with this industry and figuring out who they are and what they represent, that kind of can stall that process a little bit longer. But I think we might be mentioning it later, but I do worry slightly for Channel 4, because this is going to make some more uncertainty for them, because they never really got a fair answer as to what the hell the Tory government want to do with them and privatisation.
Yeah, well, I mean, you used to work for Channel 4. Do you think people there now are thinking, privatisation seems to be off the agenda? Ed Vasey said on Radio 4 that it was all John Whittingdale's idea.
We are a supplier to Channel 4 now, and I don't know if the shows that we make would have just the same chance of getting on air if Channel 4 was privatised. I can't see some of the shows that we make at the moment for Channel 4 appearing on Channel 5, for instance. They're sometimes a little bit too... niche or a bit off the cuff, and well, sorry, not off the cuff, wrong word. They're a little bit too niche or a bit too out there, and so we kind of celebrate Channel 4 in giving us a chance in that space.
Well, I understand the arguments against it, but do you think Channel 4 think, oh, new person in government, hopefully this won't happen now?
We just don't know. It's just another level of uncertainty, but it doesn't feel like there is as much aggression, I don't know if that's the right word, but certainly as much of a push to kind of shake things up. I think the reality is as I've always said, we've got a good plurality in TV media in this country, and that should continue.
I do feel we should sort of just, you know, have maybe a brief moment silence for Ed Vasey's passing, because, you know, poor guy, how many times is he going to be passed over for that culture secretary yeah. job, and now he's out altogether.
He'll probably end up being director general in 20 years time, but, and then, you know, he'll slide him off then.
Such a rare case of actually someone in DCMS for a long time
who cares, who
isn't disliked. So yeah. He's generally well liked, well respected, seems to get it,
likes going to the theatre,
so obviously he was doomed. I mean, you know, like, how many people did the arts sector, like how many ministers have sort of arts figures ever actually sort of liked and felt wasn't a Philistine? So maybe he went native.
I think you have to remember that he also supported Michael Gove and his premiership quite strongly, and he, you know, I don't know if this is a conspiracy theory about him being punished for that or whatever it might be, but I do, you know, I was quite that's the moment where I was a little bit disappointed with Ed kind of supporting somebody that was going to have an impact on an industry that does trade abroad and does, you know, need to have us being not as much as a torn country, unless you're a newspaper, obviously, that helps.
Although maybe Michael Gove would have brought back his sketch show with David Baddiel. I'd have liked to have seen that.
That would really help television.
I would love to see the archives of that.
I keep meaning to YouTube it. Is there anything online?
There is one 3-minute clip and almost nothing else, and it was a full series.
Yeah.
I would love to
see
that show.
Someone's got the tapes. Tweet us at the Media Podcast if you do. Right, let's talk about current telly, because in commissioning news, this announcement leaps out. Dave have commissioned Avalon to build a John Oliver-style show for their channel. It's going to be hosted by Matt Ford, the comedian, former New Labour advisor, the guy who does the political party podcast. Highly recommended if you don't listen. And it's going to aim to do for UK TV what Last Week Tonight has done for HBO. Now, for us, Avalon produced Last Week Tonight in the States, and it is a great show. And, you know, you watch it and you can kind of see what they've learnt in the UK from producing things like TV Burp as well, and they brought it over there. That said, knowing what Dave spends on TV budgets, I wonder whether you're going to have a team of sharp writers like they do on John Oliver's show being able to produce anything similar with Matt Ford.
Yeah, so Last Week Tonight is by far the best political satire show, certainly in the US, probably in the world right now. It is an excellent show, it's incredibly written, and it's delivered by an absolute comic genius. This is a difficult thing to do, and it's not the first time it's been attempted. Marcus Brigstocke, I think it was, had a show on BBC Four around political satire, where they were trying to do similar things that The Daily Show and Jon Stewart were trying to do at the time. Didn't really work. Our
10 o'clock live, of course, as well on Channel 4.
10 o'clock live, and that didn't quite land as highly as I expected it to. And I think that The issue that we have here is that our political satire is different. Have I Got News For You is an amazing show. It's an incredible political satire show. I don't think the same sort of thing would work in the US, for instance. The US have a long heritage of desk shows, of one person sitting behind a desk and tearing apart politics and the media, and it's been incredibly successful. They have it on almost 15 different news networks, not just news network, but broadcast networks, and it's you know, great stuff. But you know, they also have a much, much more polarizing media community, and actually if you look at John Oliver, if you look at John Stewart, a lot of that is sending up what's going on Fox News or what's going on CNN or what's going on in news networks, and we don't have that here because we don't have the same, you know, this
politicized broadcast.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that it's going to be more of a struggle, and I think the thing around not being able to broadcast Prime Minister's Question Times as well, and that being an issue, means that there's going to be a lack of British material around this space. And
yeah, so talk us through that, James, because some listeners won't be aware of this, because when Faraz says you can't broadcast PMQs, they think, well, yes, you can, I watch it every Wednesday, but you can't broadcast it in a comedy context.
It is one of the most joyously stupid bits of British legislation that has very little reason to still exist and almost no prospect of being changed. I mean, I don't
know. House of Lords, though. If
people watch as much politics as I do, you'll know it took about 3 years for them to agree slightly better camera angles in the Commons chamber now. You occasionally get to see almost at dispatch box level instead of always from above, which is quite nice, but that's a fixed position, and the MPs hated it. They were so against the introduction. They were tripping filmmakers, the cameramen, as they were doing it. You can only use footage from Parliament anywhere in Parliament, including, I think, select committees, which, honestly, are comedy gold these days. On box set, seriously. But you can only use it for anything that's deemed factual news or current affairs. You can't use it at all for comedy under the licensing rules. And, of course, this only applies on TV. It doesn't stop Cassette Boy or any one of numerous other people messing with the footage online. But if you want to do anything on television, you just get no rights at all, no exceptions, no footage from Parliament. And given that that's where most of our set pieces happen, I mean, the clip that you would want to show this week, if you were Have I Got News For You, or whatever the new Dave show's called, would be Theresa May at the dispatch box sort of suddenly channeling Margaret Thatcher in it's the most terrifying. She slows down, she puts her notes down and leans in. Like, I wonder how many times she practiced that in the mirror that morning. But that would be your shot, and you won't. That is the political one-liner of the week. You can't use it. And so you're really going to struggle unless you really make a gimmick of it. But you need some budget to do that. Reshoot it with actors but they're not going to have that kind of money.
I mean, I just take a very simple view on this. Isn't it just about budget? I'm going to rephrase my first question to you again. Isn't it the case that HBO chuck loads of money at John Oliver's shows and all those shows, and they all get the smartest writers straight out of Harvard, and that's all they do for a year? No one ever really properly fully commits to that in the UK. That's why most of our political satire shows like this don't work.
Well, I mean, I'd push back on you and say The Last Leg. I think The Last Leg is a political satire show that's also a talk show is been a real triumph in this space, and actually that's where the competition is here. It's not actually, you know, John Oliver and Trevor Noah, bless him. You know, it is going to be The Last Leg, and it is going to be Have I Got News For You. So it is possible, but if you look at like some great podcasts, like including things like Answer Me This, and obviously, but you know, you look at No Such Thing As A Fish, and it is possible to get lo-fi comedy writers. We do it very well in this country, and generally we don't have writers' rooms here. We have one or two incredibly good, strong comedians and strong writers that are able to kind of make it work. So
I guess Newswipe's kind of the closest, isn't it? We've come to this kind of thing.
And Newswipe works, and that's Charlie's head, and he, I think he only works for a couple of writers on that. There is no sense of a big writers' room in this country. Sometimes it causes problems. I think that Top Gear, for instance, needs a writers' room, and that's why that reboot hasn't really worked. But I think it's that there are a lot of good star talent that works in this country that doesn't need that, because they know their own personality and they are very good at their comic timing.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, before we go, there is just time for our media quiz, this week entitled The Wheel of Misfortune, with apologies to Mark Radcliffe. On the wheel before me, up here on the roof terrace, are the names of several people who work in the media, or should I say, worked, because they have recently had their job titles changed. Your job, friends, is to tell me which job they've left, and you get a bonus point if you know what they have planned next. Two spins each. The winner gets an all-inclusive holiday to the Dordogne. The loser gets a staycation. Faraz, let's spin that wheel. Good spin, my goodness. That's going very, very fast. Blue, red, pink. God, it's just a massive rainbow. Right, slowing down. Here we go. Any second now. And here we go. Question one. The wheel has landed on Colin Murray.
So he's left TalkSport.
Correct.
Because it's been bought or it's had an investment from...
Oh, it's working with The Sun, isn't it? It's got a partnership with The Sun.
According to Colin Murray's statement, he's leaving TalkSport because Rupert Murdoch's News Corp has bought the parent company of TalkSport and Court Radio, the wireless company, and Colin Murray, in sort of solidarity with the people of Liverpool over Hillsborough, says he will not work for News Corp. It's interesting, isn't it? It seems to me like this may have only just come about because it became clear the extent of the links between The Sun and Talk Radio and Talk Sport as a brand that they had planned. I mean, I wonder if it was just being owned by News Corp whether he'd have such strong objections.
I mean, it's an obvious tie-up, isn't it? I mean, it's quite a sensible thing to do if you're going to buy Talk Sport, is to join it up with The Sun. The Sun's been paying a fortune for online sports rights and doing nothing with them, really. I mean, it's a clever tie-up, but I can see why you might want to walk away from it if you feel as Colin Murray does. So
fair play to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting as well to think if The Sun do heavily invest and decide to kind of reboot The Sun Radio. Do you remember Sun Talk with John Gaunt?
It was very short-lived, wasn't it?
It was. They spent a lot of money on those studios. They wanted to work in radio.
Well, give Kelvin McKenzie something to do. He's had plenty of time in radio.
Let's be honest, we would occasionally listen to that show. It would be compelling, wouldn't it?
What would he be wearing, though? That's what we want to know.
Full burqa, please. Right, time for you to do a spin, James. Big effort, please. So, for us, a lot of effort in there. It's all right. Okay, here we go. We've got Graham, right. Baroness Una King. What's the job she's left and what's she planning to do?
So she's taking a little time away from the House of Lords, isn't
correct.
She? She's managed just to say, you know, it's helpful that Jeremy Corbyn's leader at the moment because it makes it easier to stand aside. But she's off to Google, isn't she? Head of Diversity, which I think...
At YouTube, specifically.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I good hire, I think.
Yeah, no, she was head of diversity at Channel 4, wasn't she, for
yes,
a time?
Yes, she was head of diversity at Channel 4.
Do you rate her for that?
Yeah, I think that it was a good hire for Channel 4, and I think that she did a good job there. I'm a little confused about this, I'll be honest, because I don't really understand, considering that YouTube don't make any of its own content, and, well, I mean, there's a YouTube Red stuff, but they don't really... this could be a move into that space, I don't know, but the platform has traditionally been democratised in a sense that anybody can upload anything to that. So maybe it is trying to find new communities to reach out to that platform, but I think it's a little bit more abstract than her Channel 4 role in this sense.
Well, there's sort of... It's one of those sort of fake democratic things, though. They choose a lot of people to promote and bring in and feature in their own stuff and kind of promoting YouTube stars and helping them sort of find ways to monetize. They do quite a lot of quiet work with the big names. But then, you know, I wonder also if she'll have a bit of a role in the hiring diversity there, because kind of Silicon Valley is pretty notoriously bad for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get the impression with Una King that if they're looking for someone to help a token effort or to have them say that they're handling it, I don't think she'd be that person. I think she would probably call them out if they screw it up. So it seems a fairly bold hire for them.
And I think it's quite useful to have somebody that's so ingrained with the political establishment in the UK to for YouTube to make that hire. It may have some usefulness later on down the line.
Ooh, you cynic for us. Okay, would you like to spin the wheel again?
Yes.
Very good. Okay, we're settling on Chris Evans. Faraz, what is the job he's left?
I don't know, what was Chris Evans doing? Like, I'm unaware of the job that he had and then he left. Maybe he's got in his car and driven off, or he just got a taxi. Yes, he's left Top Gear,
as
if everybody in the world knows. Wasn't it on the BBC News at 10? It was that big of a story.
It was, yeah. It was kind of actually the first post-Brexit story, almost. Chris Evans has left Top Gear, yeah.
Yeah, so he's gone. And
was it wise for him to resign, bearing in mind the BBC obviously weren't going to push him?
I think fair play to him. I think that he recognised that it was becoming an uphill struggle. I think once the reaction to the first show came out, he had to turn it round. And I think that the more that people have looked at that show and what it can be, the more they've looked at the secondary players and who the, you know, with Rory, even with Matt LeBlanc, it's been clear that actually it's not Chris that is shining through on that show, it's actually some of the secondary stars. So fair play to him to kind of stepping aside and making sure that they get a fair shot, because I think that's what that show needs. It needs some new faces that we haven't seen presenting stuff on the BBC before, giving us a fresh set of eyes and fresh set of hands on the steering wheel, as it were.
Okay, well, we're doing pretty well. You've both got your points. It's 3-2 there to Faraz, because you did say that Chris is going to Radio 2 even though he's kind of staying in his old job, really. So 3 points to Faraz, 2 to James. It's all to play for in an entirely unmanufactured way. Time to spin the wheel one final time, James. It's actually the sound of a motorbike going past, which does sound even more like a wheel than the sound effect we're using. Here goes. And it's landed on Roger Ailes.
Who
is he? A lot of people won't know who he is.
So Roger Ailes is the guy who set up Fox News. I mean, the most powerful of Rupert Murdoch's lieutenants for his entire career. It's been the cash cow, it's been the influence peddler. Like, you just never, ever thought you would see the back of him. He basically ran the Republican Party through his offices at Fox. Like, you cannot... There was just no way to say what a huge figure he was in US media. And he's gone. And it's in the midst of a whole bunch of sexual harassment suits. And Fox has usually been so good at settling anything, just keeping everything out of the headlines. But one of the sort of on-air stars managed to sort of made a complaint publicly, filed it, and then lots and lots of other people piled on. And essentially... the sense had always been that Murdoch and Ailes didn't get on as well as they used to. And, you know, Rupert Murdoch in his very late 80s was trying to encourage this man in his early 70s that it was time to retire. And so there wasn't perhaps a huge degree of warmth about trying to ride this one out. But Ailes had some very, very good contractual clauses. He could have tried to take talent with him. He could have tried to do all sorts of things. And so... they seem to have negotiated an exit, and Ailes has resigned.
He'll be getting a decent payoff, but he'll need it for the legal bills by the sounds of it.
It's rumoured to be about $40 million, and I'd be very surprised if it didn't also come with legal indemnity so that Fox can now quietly settle any of these suits. That would be what I would suspect. But, you know, he's in his 70s. I suspect he will go and enjoy spending a bit of it, and maybe a little bit of Republican Party consulting.
Which brings our grand total to 4-3. James, you've won the media quiz.
I look forward to my lavish prize.
You're as excited as a new executive at Fox News. Fair and balanced. That is our show for today. My thanks to you, James, and also to Faraz Osman. And hello to all you new listeners. Welcome to the independent home of media comment. If you subscribe to this show, and if you're not doing that, why not? Then you'll get this show every single fortnight as soon as it's released directly to your phone. You can do this via your podcast app on your iPhone. Or if you've got an Android phone, I'd recommend Pocket Casts. We're on Google Play as well now, should you use that. And subscribing means you never miss an episode, so go and do that now. This episode is dedicated to Brian Bromley, Matt Arnold, Harry Peake, and Donna McGorry, all of whom took the time to take out a voluntary subscription. In the words of Disraeli, I have an unusual sensation. If it is not indigestion, it must be gratitude. Join us, keep us on the air at themediapodcast.com/dad. dedicate. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer Matt Hill. The Media Podcast is a PPM production. Until next time, bye-bye.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.